This is Haystack Help Radio on KLZ 560. Haystack Help Radio is powered by HaystackHelp.com. Finding help can be like finding a needle in a haystack. But with HaystackHelp.com, finding the needle just got easier. Now, Haystack Help Radio with Scott Watley on KLZ 560.
Welcome to Haystack Help Radio. Thank you so much for being with us today. Hope everyone had a great, great Independence weekend and a safe weekend. I know the non-fireworks for certain areas were a little bit of a bummer to folks, but I'm telling you, the big picture of everything, I think it was an extra wise decision just for all the cost of it, the resources it would have taken from our first responders, and then just the chances for something going wrong, which I think if you watch social media much today, you will see over the weekend there was a lot of things that went wrong with professional fireworks and those doing them personal, I guess we could call it. So, but anyway, we are glad you are with us today. We are glad to welcome in for the first time Dustin Zvonik. He is a partner with the 76 Group, and I met Dustin a few weeks ago at an event that we were getting together for our Sportsman of Colorado show. And I asked Dustin if he would come in. Boy, I just found him quite interesting, and he has done a lot to help us with Initiative 302, and we'll get to that in the second half of the segment here. But Dustin, glad you came in, man. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So how was your weekend?
It was great. Like you said, it was a little bit different not having fireworks popping off everywhere. But look, as somebody who served on city council and worked with the Aurora fire team and knowing just how much of an impact that, just a little bit of a stray, a little bit of wind, a little bit of fire, and a whole lot of dry, terrain around
not
us.
Not a good combination.
It's dangerous. And, I thought about it more this year, I think, than I had in the past, just because, you see it around your own neighborhoods.
Sure.
With the water restrictions in place, just everything is so dry this year, which is a bummer. But at the end of the day, we still got to celebrate America's 250th birthday, and that's pretty special.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, tell us a little bit about yourself. You filled me in a little bit before we came on, but man, tell us a little bit about yourself. Interesting background and how you got into being a partner for 76. We'll listen.
So 76 Group is a full service public affairs company. We represent lots of major companies in from energy to land development, and we work a lot in the public policy space, which is why we're working on Initiative 302, which is the constitutional right to hunt and fish. My background is I had come out of college. I was pretty convinced I wanted to be a lawyer, was going to go to law school, took a year off, and I started working on campaigns. I've worked on several campaigns. Actually, the first campaign I managed was in 2008. Then Secretary of State Mike Kaufman was running for Congress, and I was his campaign manager. A lot of people thought he was a little bit crazy hiring this young 26-year-old to be his campaign manager in a competitive seat that was a the primary was the race back then. The old 6th congressional district at the time, the incumbent was Tom Tancredo. And so the primary was a four-way competitive primary, three other really good qualified candidates, but we ultimately won. And Mike went to serve in Congress for 10 years. I later had the opportunity to serve with Mike. He's now the mayor of Aurora, doing a great job, but I spent a term on the Aurora City Council prior to coming to 76 Group. So I ran as an at-large member there and had the opportunity to serve. It was an honor of a lifetime to get to serve the city. Enjoyed it a whole bunch. And in between, I've worked for lots of different advocacy groups, primarily supporting economic freedom, things that I am passionate about, things that I wish we had a little bit more of here in Colorado still. I moved to Colorado in 2002 to go to school, went to CSU, and I've seen that I was an intern in 2003 at the state legislature, and I've just seen the state change, as many of you all have, sure. Especially if you've lived here for a long time. But the speed at which it's changed in the past 10 years has been,
supersonic.
It's been a little bit, it's been jarring in some ways, just because every time you think it can't change anymore, it does. And I would like to say, because I'm not somebody who's opposed to change, but I don't know that we're changing for the better.
And sometimes I think about the whole Republican Democrat thing, and of course that's huge, and we'll get into that a little bit more here, but man, sometimes just some common sense things that you're just like, dude, I don't care what you are as far as political party, it's like, how could you think that would ever be a good idea?
You know, When I was younger, I'm a Republican. I've been a Republican. I was a registered Democrat initially.
Okay.
And in part because I was kind of a contrarian growing up. My grandfather was conservative, and he and I loved to argue. but I've been my adult life, I've been a Republican. And even when I was in college, this is what was the ultimate changer for me. Was I was in college. I can't remember the class now, and the professor, he was listening to me make arguments, and he knew I was a Democrat, and he's like, "Are you sure you're a Democrat?" but I've been in partisan politics. I've worked for Republican causes. I've actually only ever voted for Republican candidates. But I say all that to say that in recent years, I've become more and more a believer that I wish we actually had a system of nonpartisan politics, like the way that we have in the cities. When I ran... I ran in a city that's 4-1 Democrat by party registration. Had there been an R next to my name, I know I would have lost 60-40 because partisan politics have become blindly tribal. And, when I was running, I had the opportunity to go door to door and have conversations with people in the community and talking about issues that they cared about. I didn't have to talk about my party label. I had the opportunity to talk about public safety. It was a huge concern. This was in 2021. I was a candidate. So coming out of 2020, crime was a huge, and it still is, but it was a huge issue that my community in Aurora wanted to talk about. They wanted to talk about homelessness and how we were going to address it. They wanted to talk about the roads and what we were going to do to repair neighborhood, roads within people's neighborhoods that hadn't been fixed in a long, long time. And so you had a chance to connect with people, not as an R or a D, but as somebody like, here are my qualifications. Here are the things that I want to address as your councilman. And because I was able to do that, I was elected. And at the time, it was the most votes that had ever been received by a candidate for an at-large, member of council.
Wow.
And I tell this story. I have a good buddy. Our two boys played football, Little League football together, and he is not political whatsoever. He's registered independent, just doesn't give to anything about politics. But when I was out knocking doors, I always liked to have somebody that would carry the iPad for me and kind of tell me which homes to go to, and they'd say, hey, this is, Jane, or this is whoever, so that when I went up to the door, I could introduce myself and hand him my palm card. And when people weren't there, I would leave my door hanger behind, and then we'd move on. And sure enough, there was a home, nobody's home. Hang up the door hanger, finished knocking doors. On our way out of the neighborhood, the lady who was there, she grabs the door hanger. She's like, hey, is this you? And I said, yeah. And so we started chatting about things that were important. Again, public safety, at the time dealing with the homeless encampments that were all along Parker Road, 225. Oh, man. Frankly, lots of people would take me into their home and show me encampments behind, open space in their backyard. So we had a great conversation, and my buddy was sitting there listening to us talk. And then at the end of the conversation, she goes, hey, by the way, are you a Republican or Democrat? And I said, I'm a registered Republican, but this is a nonpartisan race. She goes, if you're a Republican, I would never vote for you. And my buddy's jaw hit the ground. He goes, what just happened? I mean, this lady agreed with literally everything you said.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, I was certain you just won a vote. And I said, this is what happens is that when you wear party labels anymore, it's just people automatically, they're like, I'll never vote for a Democrat or I'll never vote for a Republican. And more people say that than not. And I know that the majority of voters in Colorado are unaffiliated. They're still partisan.
But they're really not.
They're really not, right? I mean, they're really not. Mm-hmm. They're still voting almost exclusively for one party over the other. The number of people who truly vote for the person and not the party, despite everybody saying that, it's pretty small.
Yeah.
And I wish that wasn't the case. I really do wish that we had a system
where they'd really look at, like what I just picked up from what you said, at the candidate, what they want to do, what you feel like they can do,
right?
And is that going to be better for Colorado?
You think about it like a job interview, right? When you're interviewing somebody for a job, you want to know, what are your qualifications? What have you done that would indicate to me that you can do this job? And I don't know that there's any, you know, set of qualifications that uniquely make you qualified for public office. There's things that are beneficial, but it's such a different role. Even executive roles. I know a lot of guys who, men and women, who've been in you know, business roles and like, oh, I've been a CEO, I should be a governor. That's not exactly how it works because I've been a CEO. I've been a CEO of a bank and a nonprofit where, you know, you get to make decisions. whereas when you're a governor, you get to make decisions kind of, but you also have this, you know, legislature that has a lot to say. But so there aren't necessarily, but there are things that you would look at from an experience standpoint if you were doing an interview of a candidate. But then you also want to know, like, what do you believe in? What do you want to accomplish? Because these seats, they belong to the people. And, you know, the people who run for office have the opportunity to hold them. It's like, okay, if we give you the opportunity to hold this office, what are you going to do? What are you going to do to make our lives better, our community better, our state better? And I just feel like with what's happened with the parties, and maybe this is why, you know, go back to the Federalist Papers, they warned about this two-party system, is it's become less about, although the rhetoric around it was like, oh, we want to serve and we want to help, but it's become less about that and more about holding power, holding majority power. Each party wants to have the majority because then they have the power. And it's moved away from being about, you know, what I believe, the reason why when people ask me, who's your favorite founding father, I'll say George Washington, because he was the ultimate, you know, public servant for the country. This is a guy who may be the only human in history that walked away from the relative amount of power he had willingly. You know, he said, nope, I think it's time to move on and give somebody else an opportunity to serve. And I just don't think that there's enough. I think there's a lot of good men and women who serve, don't get me wrong. But I think the parties have become more about accumulating control and power than about serving people.
Mm-hmm. Dustin Zvonik is with us. Once again, he is a partner with the 76 Group. You help a lot with different petitions around, and we've seen a lot of that lately, Initiative 302 and others. Kind of explain a little bit of how that works, because it's very interesting. You know, most of us, I'd never been involved with anything like this till Initiative 302, and I've come out of grocery stores. People always want you to sign stuff and do different things. But tell us kind of how that works.
Yeah. No, look, I think this is one of the really it's one of the great features that we have in Colorado is this ability for direct democracy where – And it's interesting because, you know, as we've talked about the state kind of having a leftward drift, maybe drift's not the strong enough word, but it's, you know, I think that there's more and more there's a disconnect between that blind tribalism that people are showing at the ballot when it comes to elected officials. So they're voting for Democrats, but then they're voting for public policy initiatives that are put in front of them that are more conservative or more center right, or they're voting against tax increases over and over again. There seems to be a disconnect where people still want common sense, maybe more conservative leaning policy, and yet they're electing more progressive candidates. And this citizen initiative process, what it's allowed is for people to access the ballot in a way that can fundamentally change public policy around the legislature. And just some recent examples is that I've been, you know, the legislature, I'd say going back to about 2018, 2019, has progressively made the state less safe with some of their public policy, some of the public policies that they've passed. And there have been ballot measures that have countered that. And the voters have overwhelmingly supported it. And so the process is not, it's not easily accessible in the sense that it's a big number. You know, you have to get 125,000, you know, signatures. And if it's a constitutional measure, which is, you know, Initiative 302 is a constitutional measure, there's a requirement to hit a threshold in each of Colorado's 35 state senate districts. So it's an expensive endeavor. But if you have an issue that can generate the support financially, you can get these things on the ballot and you put them in front of people. And these are many times, these are policies that the legislature and the governor would never sign, never put into place, but voters will. Mm-hmm. And I think that's exactly what's going to happen with a number. There's going to be maybe one of the biggest ballots this year in Colorado's history. And I think that it's 2/3 of it are issues and policies that are likely next governor and legislature would never support, but they're going to pass, and they'll pass comfortably.
Interesting. So explain how it works a little bit. Every idea, every push we want to make starts out as an initiative.
That's right.
Then if it gets the right signatures, it'll have an amendment number assigned to it. If it doesn't, it's done.
That's right. That's right. So there's a couple of different paths to the ballot. So and it depends on if it's statutory or constitutional. But I'll talk through this, the citizen-led side. If it's a statutory or constitutional, the first step is you have to take a concept, policy idea, and run it through a process called title board. And the title board is comprised of a representative from the Secretary of State, the Attorney General's Office, and Legislative Council. So there's three member board, and what their job is to take, you know, if you wanted to come in, you have an idea, just like with the constitutional right to hunt and fish, you come with proposed language, and they have to determine one is because Colorado has a very strict single subject, which is a good thing, single subject law for any law. So unlike in Congress where you have these Christmas tree bills, because mm-hmm. they just, you can't do that in Colorado. It's a single subject. And if something is in the bill that doesn't apply to the subject, now there's some interpretation there, but it's pretty tough standard, but you have to have a single subject. So the title board has to determine, is this a single subject and does it conform within existing Colorado law? And then they set a title. Typically what organizations or groups or individuals that want to get a title set either for statute or for constitution or for a constitutional amendment do is they'll run a couple of variations. And we did the same for the right to hunt and fish, knowing that the title board is going to, you know, say we like this, we don't like this. And the process takes about a month from start to finish, from when you first submit and you go through what's called review and comment, and then you go to the title board hearing. Oftentimes it's challenged, right? If it's a controversial issue, the other side might try to challenge it and say, hey, no, this does violate single subject. In fact, recently there was some pretty big news where the Colorado Supreme Court threw out some redistricting measures that were being pushed by progressive groups to gerrymander Colorado's congressional districts. That was big news. And the reason that they ended up doing it was that you had two measures that were dependent upon each other, which essentially meant that they weren't single subject. They tried to get around single subject by having two measures, but they were completely interdependent. And so the Supreme Court threw it out. So you go through that process of getting a title set. Then once you get a title set, you have 6 months to collect the necessary signatures. And if it's a statute, that's just 125,000, period. Doesn't matter where you get them from. If it's constitutional, you have that state Senate requirement.
Yeah. Wow. A lot to know.
Yeah.
Hey, when we come back, we're going to talk about Initiative 302 and the role that Dustin and his group played in that. So you're listening to Haystack Help Radio. We'll be right back.
How much do you need to lower your monthly mortgage payment? $200, $300, $400 or more? As rates decline, take AIM, Affordable Interest Mortgage, 720-895-0500. Over 24 years of saving Coloradans money. Low rates, lower payments, less costs. What makes us different is we listen. As an independent mortgage broker, we shop the top lenders to save you the most. Affordable Interest Mortgage, 720-895-0500. Want to purchase your next home? You can't qualify unless you sell your current home? Let us show you how to get the down payment out of your current home, qualify for the new one, and then sell yours for the most. Affordable Interest Mortgage, 720-895-0500. So you want to buy a home. Let us show you loans that can save you money, low down payment, first-time home buyer specials, fixed rates in the fours with buy-downs. Call for details, 720-895-0500, or apply now at aimortgage.net. That's Affordable Interest Mortgage, where it's all about you. Regulated by DORA and MLS 217-147, Equal Credit Lender.
This is KLZ 560, your home station.
Welcome back to the show. If you're just joining us, Dustin Zvonik is with us. He is a partner with the 76 Group, and Dustin also helped tremendously with Initiative 302, which we are gathering signatures for the Constitution to get it on the ballot, it would be a constitutional right to hunt and fish in Colorado. And that's where I met Dustin a few weeks ago, and so I wanted to get him on the show. You were telling me before the show, this came to you a little later than you would have liked. Most of the time, like you just said, 6 months, and, you know, this came to you within what?
Yeah, so it came in – so the deadline is August 4th because they have to set the ballot for okay. this fall's election. And we started the signature gathering process in May, second week of May. So we had about 90 days, which is an incredibly fast – it's a short time frame to collect the signatures. Now, backing up, we started the process because I was mentioning the title setting process. We started that in April.
Okay.
And that came about because, as you may know, there has been an ongoing effort, and it looks like it'll actually be on the ballot this fall in Oregon, that would actually criminalize hunting and fishing in the state of Oregon. And there were some people here in the state that were quite concerned, who care about hunting and fishing and view it as an important part of Colorado's heritage, and did not want to see that type of measure make its way here. I mean, one of the things that you learn in this public policy business is that, you know, states are always looking over the borders to see what other states are doing on all sorts of policy questions, whether it's tax or anything. And Oregon tends to be a state that, unfortunately, Colorado lags a couple cycles behind in terms of bad ideas. And this is a very bad idea for the state of Oregon. But so you had a couple of gentlemen reached out to us and said, hey, listen, can we, you know, potentially look at doing what was done in Florida 2 years ago, which was put a constitutional measure on the ballot for voters to put into our constitution a right to hunt and fish, to get ahead of this. And we said, sure, we can give it a shot. And so we looked at the language and worked with the group that pushed it in Oregon, is the International Order of Teddy Roosevelt and T. Roosevelt Action, their sister organization. They put together a campaign in Florida and passed it in 2024, did a great job. So we reached out to them and said, hey, listen, would you be willing to, one, help us craft the language to make sure that we're doing it right. And then two, this is going to be a big effort. And so we're going to need lots of support from, you know, there's a lot of people here in the state that care about it, but can you help us and connect us to some of the folks around the country who understand how important hunting and fishing is? Even if they don't live in Colorado, they'd recognize that making sure it's protected here is a priority. And so we started that process in April and got it through title board, got favorable language, I believe, and started collecting signatures in May.
Wow. And when we talk about support, we don't just mean voting for it. Man, this is expensive.
It is. Yeah. I mean, look, to the paid, circulating business it's expensive. It's just... it's an unfortunate that the number is what it is, but it makes sense to put something in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. There should be a high threshold, and having that requirement of a certain percentage done in each of the 35 Senate districts also makes it challenging, in part because if you ever look at our state Senate district map in Colorado, you have some of these giant rural ones where it's just hard to find density where people are and to get those signatures, and then there's others where they're so jammed together that you've got to make sure you're, you know, so you can be at one King Supers and there can be three different Senate districts that people, you know, all shop at.
Right.
So it is an expensive endeavor. And then the campaign is going to cost, you know, it's going to be an expensive campaign. I believe it will be successful. I think that this is, you know, the right to hunt and fish isn't a partisan issue. And I think that's the reason it performed so well in Florida. They received almost 1 million more votes than the president did on the ballot in 2024.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And that just shows you that it's not just one party or the other. This is, it's truly a bipartisan, it's a common sense issue. And for people who care about, even if you don't hunt or fish, and a lot of people fish, not, you know, there's fewer people that hunt, but a lot of people fish. But I think there's still, even those who don't, who recognize the value from an economic standpoint and just from a cultural and heritage standpoint, what it means to the state of Colorado.
Yeah. I think one reason we were in that Prop 127, you know, that we did, is because, we tried to go to, we weren't going to convince the total anti-hunters.
That's right.
The hunters were good. we had to educate a lot, and I hate to always say that because I don't want to mean like we're talking down to people. We just had to educate them a little bit about what mountain lion hunting was really like. They just thought we could go shoot as many as we want and shoot all you want. They just didn't understand and how, you know, mountain lion will kill a deer a week. I mean, they didn't understand that it's a conservation type deal. And once we got to educating a lot of people about that and why dogs were used and different things like that, you know, I think that's why we did it, because we kind of had a boots on the ground. Do you think that's going to take a little bit of that effect?
I do.
Once this gets
and
on
I
the
think
ballot?
Very similarly to that, the right to hunt and fish doesn't mean that you don't have a division of wildlife that, that you know, hands out fishing licenses and hunting licenses. And it doesn't mean that they can't make decisions. It doesn't get rid of the Endangered Species Act, right? You still have to comply within in the law. But what it does is when you ask those questions around conservation, it forces you, which is a good thing, to rely on science and not emotion, right? Because a lot of these attempts to ban hunting on, you know, whether it's different types of animals it's based on an emotional decision that they don't want to do it, as opposed to looking at the science and the reason that it's important to have it, hunting be a part of conservation. And I think that that is actually in the language, that it requires, you know, if there's ever going, that's how a constitutional challenge would come about if this were to be in place in Colorado, is that if a decision were ever made, you'd have to be able to prove on scientific grounds that it was necessary. And if it is, great. Right. And if it's not, then it would violate the Constitution. Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of stats shared at the event I met you at. So I don't want to say it wrong, and you may not remember, but there was something. We got to get hunters to vote.
Yeah.
That's what I'm just trying to say.
Yeah.
So share whatever you can recall from that meeting about, you know, because there's a lot. I mean, I think Dan Gage, Colorado's for Responsible Wildlife Management, said, you know, if like 30% of the licensed hunters would have voted against the wolf, we'd have won that hands down.
Hands down.
So help us out there a minute.
That was one of the unique things, you know, T. Roosevelt Action and their team, they're the ones that brought this to my attention. You know, Luke Hilgeman, who was their CEO, good friend, he's from Wisconsin, and he talked about, you know, when he got involved in politics, he's like, hunters vote, of course they vote. And once you start pulling the data and you see that it's, you know, just a small percentage of hunters that actually turn out and vote. So what they did in Florida, when they went to pass the right to hunt and fish there, was that they had a very targeted campaign where what they realized was that a lot of people who hunt and who fish, Florida obviously being more of a fishing destination than a hunting destination, so a lot of people who fish, they don't care about politics, right? And I think this is true of a lot of Americans. They live their lives. They're worried about their family, their job, and fishing or hunting.
Yeah,
right?
Sure.
And so they had to say, hey, look, we're not going to reach them and educate them, right, through the traditional means of the way you would on a political campaign. And so they had to talk through, to try to get their message through people who had an audience that was different, that they refer to it as their influencer model. These are outdoor wildlife influencers who people want to, you know, they're interested in them because they're bow hunters or because, you know, they're the largest XYZ fly fishermen or whatever.
Right.
And so they wanted to connect with them and through them to these people who are disconnected from your traditional political, marketing campaigns and get them educated and activated. And they saw a huge number. And that's what they attribute that million more votes or nearly a million more votes than the president got in Florida to the fact that they were able to turn out more hunters that had traditionally just not voted. And so we're going to have to do something similar to Colorado, because one of the, and you saw this with 127 and other, you know, the wolf reintroduction was probably a better example of this, where the metro area has grown significantly. There's more suburbs. And meanwhile, the rural parts of the state are shrinking. And frankly, these types of policies disproportionately impact our rural communities. And they're being made, the decisions to whether or not to pass them statewide are being made by people in the Denver metro area. So it's going to be important that we get hunters out, because they, especially those who live in the Denver metro area. And to your point about educating, making sure that people in Highlands Ranch or in Thornton, wherever, in the Denver metro area, understand how important that the right to fish and hunt is to the state of Colorado, but again, economically as well. I mean, it's a huge, you know, revenue driver for the state, both in terms of what it generates locally and then also from people coming in from around the country and frankly from around the world to hunt here.
Yeah, good deal. Tua, we got to take a break. Dustin, we appreciate it very, very much.
Yeah, of course.
Great information, and we're going to keep everybody well informed on this. Thanks for being with us. Don't go anywhere, though. More coming right back right after this.
Riding an e-bike will make you feel like a kid again. Just try it. Hi, I'm Randy Kranzi, founder of eBike of Colorado. E-bikes are a fun way to ride around town. Pedal Assist technology flattens the steepest hills. We have 14 major brands to choose from, and our expert staff will find you the perfect bike. Come take a free test ride at eBike of Colorado in downtown Louisville next to the historic grain elevator. Open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Learn more at ebikeofcolorado.com. Just try it.
You're listening to 560 KLZ, your home station.
Welcome to Your Health Matters, sponsored by Integrated Health Systems. Traditional medicine has left you frustrated. You've seen doctor after doctor searching for answers, only to feel more confused than ever. Chiropractic neurologist Dr. Shane Stedman, along with his team at Integrated Health Systems, does the detective work you need to identify causes, not just treat your symptoms. Using a team approach to combine functional medicine with neurology, Integrated Health Systems spends the necessary time with each client to find out what's really going on. Thanks to Dr. Stedman and his team, many clients who struggle with debilitating health issues have finally found relief. Now, Haystack Help Radio proudly presents Your Health Matters.
And we'd like to welcome you to Your Health Matters, as mentioned, brought to you by Integrated Health Systems. Their number, 303-781-5617, for a free initial consult. And it doesn't matter what our topic is each week. Whatever is ailing you, you give them a call. And again, they will do a free initial consult. Well, it's always good to have Dr. Perry Maynard with us. Dr. Maynard, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing great, Scott. How are you doing?
I'm good. Survived the fourth weekend.
Yes, yeah. Did you do anything fun?
You know, we had some great friends over and just kind of cooked out on, you know, grilled out a little bit. And Douglas County had, as with several other areas, had, you know, canceled fireworks. And, you know, I get it. You know, I mean, good night. I like fireworks just as much as anybody. But I think that was a very wise move. You know, a lot of people were upset saying, well, they ought to allow professional people. Well, professional people can't control the wind.
It's just so dry. And it doesn't sound like they're messing around. I had a patient in earlier who told me their neighbor got fined $17,000 for lighting off fireworks this weekend.
Yeah, Douglas County was that in Douglas County?
I don't. Okay. That's a great question. It might have been. Well, they're out in, like, Littleton, Ken Carroll area, so I don't know if that falls under Douglas County.
Yeah, I don't either. Okay, I'm not quite sure, but, yeah.
I don't think they were not messing around. I was like, $17,000 fine. I was like, that is crazy.
Man.
But I get it. I mean, the fires are really bad.
Yeah.
And the last thing we need is something in a residential area like, you know, how long ago was that fire? A few years ago up north.
Just a couple of years. Like, yeah. I mean, that was just 2 or 3 years ago. Yeah. It could have been four, but I mean, time goes so quick. But it was recent.
Yeah, and you think it's devastating in, you know, the mountains where there's not a lot of people living. You know, the last thing we need is something getting down to residential areas. So I definitely get it. Yeah,
right.
It's pretty dry. It's funny. We did some yard work, and we were planting some things in our yard, and it's like, oh man, the ground. I was trying to kind of break up the ground, and it just was
so
rock solid. I don't know the last time it saw any moisture.
Yeah, you need to hire people to do that, Dr. Maynard. So, you know, you don't want to hurt yourself, you know.
Yeah, right. That's true.
Hey, we are glad you're with us. You know, before we get into today's topic a little bit, I was just kind of looking at some things on the website, that, and it's been a little while since we've kind of talked about just the what is functional medicine a little bit, you know. And of course, I think the thing I've always just pointed to is just, you know, finding out what's wrong with you. So I guess identifying what's wrong with someone and then, you know, trying to address those root causes. I mean, that's where I've kind of always started with it. But is it more than that?
No, I think that's a great way to look at it. I think, you know, honestly, the biggest thing that I think sets, you know, things apart is, I think, like you and I talked about, is like, you know, the biggest difference between the insurance model mm-hmm. and maybe ours is honestly like time. You know, I think about this, and sometimes I think, you know, medicine can get a bad rap for, you know, certain things, but when you look at the way a lot of things are set up between time, insurance reimbursements, right, standards of care, you know, I think, you know, so, you know, I think they are also trying, you know, I think most doctors, right, want to get to the root of what someone has going on, you know, but when you are in a situation when you have 15 minutes or less with a patient and then you're kind of handcuffed with what is the standard of care for maybe what you have found, right? And there's not a lot of wiggle room. So, you know, I think what's really helpful with how we go about things is we don't let time or those things limit us. You know, I think you and I have talked about that, you know, sometimes 2, 3, maybe even 4 hours with a patient, right? We're not limited on, mm-hmm. you know, how much time. I actually was talking to my friend, you know, we were kind of joking, or we were trying to figure out like appointments and running behind and stuff like that. And I've really, you know, even switched to spending, you know, more time. And although that may see less people, it's like it really allows you to really figure out what's going on. I mean, I had a patient earlier today. So she's got, you know, chronic fatigue. She's got joint pain, muscle aches. When she exercises, she becomes bedbound, she's dizzy, she's got all these symptoms, right? And this was kind of like our third visit. So, you know, we had met initially, talked, did an examination, did another visit. So I guess this was the fourth time, right? And her mom was in with her today. And it makes me think of this question where it's like we were kind of chatting through. It's like, hey, you know, there's 5 different things that could contribute to your symptoms, right? And the nice thing about, I guess, whether you call it the functional medicine approach or just how I think healthcare should be, is like we were able to spend the time and really kind of dive through each of those things and then discuss, hey, here's a treatment approach for each one. Maybe, hey, here's priority. Let's start here. Let's see how you respond here. So I think that's really the biggest thing, is like it's not being rushed. It's like actually giving people the time of day, man. It's like, I take, this is a separate subject, but like I take my car to the dealership, you know, or a mechanic all the time, and I swear no one listens to me. I like come and I ask him, I'm like, wait, hold on. You say you check this, but like, what about those 5 other things I told you about? And then they're like, oh yeah, we never got to that. And it's like, I think healthcare is the same way. It's like, you know, and I've seen doctors do this where they like triple book themselves. And it's like they're trying to fit like 3 people into 1 appointment slot. And it's like, there's no way you're going to get to that patient's needs. And so like, yes, there's a lot of people sick. And yes, maybe our model isn't the most efficient way to see the masses. But the current system we have right now is just definitely not cutting it when it comes to chronic health issues. And I think a lot of that is just spending the time to really sit down and listen to a patient, review their things, and then create a sought-after plan. That just can't be done in a 15-minute window, right? And it's and how do you have a standard of care for each of those? It's the system is just broken. So I think this allows us, you know, being outside of the insurance realm, which a lot of people don't like, and I get it, right? I pay for insurance. I want to use my insurance as well.
Sure.
Just unfortunately, to do it right, you know, it's like, this is kind of a separate thing. I was talking to my mom. My uncle is having some, you know, neurological issues. It has been 6 months that it has taken him to get an MRI And I think maybe he's got a follow-up with, like, a surgeon finally. Like, he's been out of work for months. And, you know, I kept talking to my mom. I was like, hey, I will order the stuff. Let's look at, you know what I mean? But I think going through, you know, Medicare and all these hoops and things, and you got to fail this. And it's just like, it's crazy. It is crazy how long it takes to get anywhere in this current healthcare system. So that's where we kind of take matters into our own hand. And we say, hey, we think the system is broken. We're going to go about it this way. Yes, things are out of pocket and they may be a little bit more expensive, but honestly, the amount of money people lose in lost wages,
sure,
I don't think it even comes close.
No, I agree with you. I agree with you. Now, you mentioned a lady came in, had those number of issues, and you said her mother came with her. So I'm just going to ask you a question. Yeah. Are you surprised to see how sick some 20 to 30-year-old, 40-year-olds can be, you know, at that age?
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, and this patient was probably in their mid to late 30s, right?
Oh, wow.
And like, it's pretty wild, and like, I don't, and it's not right because people need their mom, and it's like because they're truly sick.
Sure,
like,
sure.
I think if you have a, yeah, I think if you have a late 20, early 30, early 40, and a mom is joining, you know, a lot of times from what I'm seeing, it's because like the parent is so frustrated. They're like, I've been seeing my daughter not get answers for over a year now, and she's sick, and they've probably sat on the sideline, and they've probably gotten to the point where they're like, hold on, like, what is going on? Like, you are still not well. And I think that's really quite eye-opening if we're at that place and that is occurring. And, you know, she was a prime example, I think, going back to the model. So, and I see this a lot in patients, and a lot of people listening, this might ring true. So, right, and this kind of comes into the autoimmune realm is, you know, we've been seeing so many patients with some of the positive testing for autoimmune conditions. So there's a marker called ANA, or anti-nuclear antigen or antibody. So it's a kind of like an initial lab that is run by rheumatologists or PCPs or whoever to start screening for autoimmune diseases. It itself is not indicative of any specific condition. Usually if it's positive and there's symptoms, there's more labs that are run to explore conditions like rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, Sjogren's, you know, all sorts of rheumatological conditions. And you're seeing, you know, and you can see these antibodies in quote-unquote healthy asymptomatic individuals, but you're seeing this large group of people who have crippling fatigue. Like, they have all the symptoms of autoimmune conditions. They have the positive ANA, but it's either not high enough or they don't have some of the other things that come with it, that they're just being ignored. And this was a patient that we saw today. And I understand the world is very complex and there's a lot of things, but there's a large group of individuals who are being ignored. And I think this is what I see a lot of times in traditional healthcare is like, unless things fit a perfect picture that is perfectly clinically clear, then nothing happens to the patient. You know what I mean? Like, I think especially when you look at autoimmune conditions is, you know, unless it's blatantly obvious that the joint is being eroded or destroyed or the thyroid is being destroyed or the brain, you know, has white matter lesions on MRI, you have these patients who are in this weird gray area where their lab work is positive, they have all the symptoms, but when you look at imaging, everything is negative, or they just don't seem bad enough. And it's really sad to see, because these are the patients that we're seeing where, you know, it's not like, you know, I think alternative healthcare gets a bad rap of like, oh, you're not, you know, patients aren't going through the routes they should, and they should be seeing this person. Like, all the patients we're seeing, they've already been that route. They've been to five rheumatologists. They've been to medical neurologists. Like, they're coming to us because they don't have answers, and or they're just being gaslit, right? They're just being told, you know, the same patient, her primary care was like, yep, you know, healthy people can have these same lab findings, so I don't think there's anything wrong with you. And she was like, but I have all the symptoms. She's like, I can't get out of bed. I have joint pain. Like, I have all the symptoms. If you were to look it up in a medical textbook, I have the antibodies. Why won't you refer me? You know, so it's like, this ultimately is like why we end up existing, is that these patients are just not being served, you know. And I don't know, I think it goes back to, like we talked about, there's certain standards that are set by certain higher bodies, insurance companies, certain medical organizations, and I understand having diagnostic criteria, but what about the people that don't fit that, right, and that are still sick and disabled, right? And that's where, you know, it's like, we don't gaslight patients. We don't tell them it's all in their head. It's like there's something going on, and that's where you need the time to really look underneath and explore and then find a treatment and then ultimately see if that treatment is helpful. That can be confirmatory as well. So, the system is just a mess.
Sure. Dr. Perry Maynard is with us once again, Integrated Health Systems. When you have multiple symptoms like that, how do you go about deciding what to tackle first, so to speak?
It's a great question. And I actually was chatting with, I think Liz and I were chatting about this. You know, I think there's different symptoms that I kind of have a linear, like let's talk about dizziness and then maybe we can talk about fatigue because this is something we see quite a bit. I think when you look at a certain symptom, let's take dizziness, the history is like the biggest thing. So honestly, a really detailed history of a symptom. So let's take dizziness. How does someone describe it? What was its onset? What makes it better? What makes it worse? How long does it last? All these descriptors are really, really helpful because when you look at something like dizziness, right, that might be maybe vertigo, but someone doesn't know how to quite describe it. It could be disequilibrium where someone just feels like, I hear a lot of people describe it as like, I just feel drunk or off balance all the time, or I feel like I'm walking on like a dock that's wobbling, or maybe it's a lightheadedness. So history is really important. And then from there, off the history, we can start to have an idea like, does this seem maybe more inner ear? Does this seem more visual? Does this seem more blood flow? Or does this seem more metabolic? And then that will allow us to run testing off of that, right? And kind of guide our testing and kind of work through that clinical diagnosis. Kind of same thing when you look at things like fatigue. I would say I think fatigue is much harder.
Mm-hmm.
For me personally, I find dizziness not to be a super difficult symptom to kind of work up. That's not all the time, but I think we're pretty good with that most of the time. But when you look at fatigue is a hard one, right? When you look at some of the research around fatigue, there's so many different mechanisms or even what we would call like subtypes, right? So like, is it body fatigue? Is it cognitive or brain fatigue? Is it both? Is it acute recent? Is it longer? How did it start? But when you look at fatigue, like I said, going back to subtypes, there can be metabolic drivers of fatigue. So this could be diabetes, prediabetes, other forms of metabolic disease or liver issues. There can be neuroinflammatory conditions, so where there's inflammation in the brain contributing to fatigue. Fatigue can be neuroendocrine, so these are things like thyroid issues or sex hormone issues or adrenal hormone issues. Another aspect of fatigue that I see get overlooked quite a bit is this idea of cognitive fatigue, where it's actually coming from the brain, and you see this quite a bit in individuals suffering from depression,
mm-hmm.
right? And you'll have depression patients where like they can't, you would think they had the flu, right? And so you're like, man, they look just like a patient that has the flu, but it's more brain-based, right? And the way you test for that is very different. The way you screen for that is very different. So, and then the last one is blood flow or autonomic. So I've kind of set up or made it to where we have the tools to kind of explore all these subtypes. So if someone comes in with fatigue, right, we take a detailed history. When did it start? How did it start? How would you describe it? Right, all these details about their fatigue. And then sometimes it becomes very clear, this seems more, you know, when I eat a very sugary meal, I crash and I get fatigued, right? We're thinking, okay, this seems more metabolic blood sugar. Let's explore that. But for some patients, you don't know, and you kind of got to look at all these different things. You got to look at hormones. You have to look at cognitive testing. So for the brain side, we'll look at neurological testing. We'll look at cognitive testing. We'll look at screening for depression, anxiety, other psychiatric issues. And then for autonomic, this is where we'll explore blood flow like you and I have talked about in the past, and then get kind of an idea of like, what is this person's mechanism?
Right.
And then from there, it is trying to solve it. So kind of like this patient I had earlier, all of her autoimmune testing is popping positive. She's got some other things that could contribute to fatigue, but that's where we're like, okay, this seems like this could be very much immune inflammatory based. So we need to try to create a team for this patient and treatment strategies to help manage and support her immune system and inflammation along with other providers. And if we are correct, we should see that fatigue get better. So a lot of it is sometimes also treatment and trial and error. Is like, hey, this seems like a pretty good hypothesis. This, you know, it seems like you have more things that are positive in this arena. Let's explore some sort of treatment strategy. And then a lot of times, if you see that individual say, hey, I feel better, my fatigue is better, you now have a history, positive lab tests, and a treatment, all kind of help to fit that narrative of what is going on, right? Because the treatment for an immune-based fatigue is very different than a cognitive fatigue, and that's very different than a blood flow. And so that's why it's really important, and that's why there's no standard of care. Once again, if you look back at traditional healthcare, what is the standard of care for fatigue and treatment? There isn't really one. And so these patients a lot of times get tossed on psych meds. They get told to sleep more, rest more, whatever it may be.
Yeah.
But usually, right, there's a route. And so that's where, like I said, these things take time. You cannot do all of that in 15 minutes, right? This can take multiple visits sometimes. I mean, sometimes it takes 4 or 5 visits of testing, retesting to really kind of figure out what is going on.
Right. And, you know, I've said this, I told Dr. Stedman this, I mean, through the years, early on when he and I first met, I was like, man, I do not get the name of your company, Integrated Health Systems. It sounded like computer stuff to me, you know, and I told him that. But then the more we've gotten into this, of course, and understanding the body, man, there's no better word for the body than a system, you know?
And, yeah, it is.
And it doesn't take.
It is a system indeed.
Yeah, and it doesn't take, but, you know, one imbalance if we're lucky, but it doesn't take, you know, just one that can really throw off your whole body, can it?
It can for sure. I mean, I think both sides. I think it's wild how durable the human body is and also what it can get away with. Sometimes you see people's labs or images and you're like, how are you upright? And then you see other individuals with little things going on falling apart. And I think that goes to show, you know, people are so different and not everyone responds the same, right? And that's why we have to be very careful just using these static images. I think traditional healthcare has gotten so bad about, like, think about it. Like, the last time you went to the doctor, like, do they really touch you or examine you? No, they talk to you for 5 minutes and then maybe they take an image and now they feel like they have your whole life story.
Sure.
And it can be so misleading because, once again, you know, things can look so bad, but people can be asymptomatic or vice versa. All the imaging is negative and someone feels awful. So, it's a system. And like you said, you know, what the brain, I think the biggest thing for me is the brain and neurology and what someone's brain or issues neurologically, what that can create. I think that is a very scary but very interesting area of, like, when that goes wrong, a lot, I think, can go wrong.
Right. Last 3 or 4 minutes here, but one thing I want to touch on, and I was hoping to get into some patient stories, but this is a great topic. But, you know, the testing that you guys have just, it seems like every year you just keep growing and growing and growing with testing. And I would say, and there's probably a better medical term, but I would say you guys have some state-of-the-art testing. Would you agree?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think, you know, every year we are trying to kind of explore, like, how can we better serve our patients? You know, I think, you know, like an example would be, you know, there was a testing I was always wanting to get for patients called punch biopsy testing to explore certain types of neuropathies. And I was always trying to find neurologists and referrals. And it was just always proving to be so difficult. And it just really would push back patient's timeline of getting diagnoses. So everything we do is to try to say, hey, how can we better serve our patients? Like, where are we lacking? What is affecting our ability to get to the root of people's problems? And then, you know, bringing them on. So, yeah, each year, you know, I definitely am, I love technology. I love being able to have objective info, you know, not only to get patients answered, but also to track our outcomes, right? I want to make sure that we're actually kind of doing what we're saying and we're seeing things change. So, yeah, we're always trying to bring on new stuff to better serve patients.
Right. So in that initial intake here, you kind of look at what, genetics, nutrition, lifestyle, what else kind of goes into kind of what you look at with a patient?
Yeah, I mean, all of those. I mean, I think when you look at, like, let's just say history, yeah, it is, you know, everything back to childhood sometimes, right? Of, like, childhood traumas, were they abused? Was there sexual abuse? What are their family history with their mom, their dad, their grandparents? Were they really sick, you know, at some point when they're a kid? I mean, sometimes these things can tell you a lot. You know, it's like almost creating a whole timeline. You know, I think sometimes people are like, I don't really, this doesn't make sense. And then you kind of walk through the timeline and they say it out loud and then they're like, ooh, now that I say that, that seems kind of obvious how this came up. You know what I mean? You'd be surprised where people are like, yeah, I don't know, I got headaches, I can't really think of anything that happened. Then you work through the timeline, they're like, well, you know, I got in a car accident, I had COVID and I was in a hospital, you know what I mean? It's like, you start going through all these things, they're like, yeah, I guess around that time, my health really started to spiral. So it's like, yeah, all we go pretty detailed. I mean, our health histories sometimes are 45 minutes, right? Wow. Going back to the system. Like, I go to doctor's appointments myself. The history or the review of systems, do you have any shortness of breath? No? Okay, good. Do you go to the bathroom? Yeah, you know what I mean? It's like, they're important things, but like,
right. It's
kind of like checking boxes to make sure that there's no glaring issue, but not getting into detail. So yeah, it's looking at all those things. I think all of those things can paint that person's story to understand what is going on.
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Maynard, we appreciate your time. I'm sure I'll see you in the next few days, and I hope you have a great rest of your week.
Thanks, Scott. Have a good one.
All right, you as well. That's Dr. Perry Maynard, Integrated Health Systems. Once again, folks, free initial consult. Just give them a call, 303-781-5617. Hope you have a great rest of your day, and all of you have a great week, and we'll talk to you tomorrow at noon.
Call Integrated Health Systems now for a free consultation. 303-781-5617. That's 303-781-5617. To book your consultation online, visit integratedhealthdenver.com. Thank you for listening to Your Health Matters. Be sure to join Dr. Shane Steadman live every Monday at 12:30 p.m. on KLZ 560.
The views and opinions expressed on KLZ 560 are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of Crawford Broadcasting, the station, management, employees, associates, or advertisers. KLZ 560 is a Crawford Broadcasting God and Country station.